Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. The pursuit of civil rights isn't always linear, and throughout the history of our country, we've made steps forward and backward on the journey. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. reminded us that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Later in the hour, we'll talk about some of the present-day challenges and how we move forward as a community to ensure civil rights for all. But we start the hour with a look back at one incident that changed the course of civil rights in our country. Joining us is John Beter. He's an Emmy-nominated filmmaker whose documentaries explore themes of resistance, social justice, medicine, and substance use, and often illuminating overlooked or underrepresented voices. His latest film, How to Sue the Klan, a collaboration with renowned civil rights attorney Ben Crump, won an NAACP Image Award and tells the story of five Black women who helped bring down a local Klan chapter through a pivotal civil suit. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Mindy. It's great to be here.
So before we talk about the film itself, would you set the scene for what it was like for people in Chattanooga, Tennessee in the early 1980s?
Absolutely. So, a lot of this is coming from the people that we spoke to and the participants in our film. But in the 1980s, Chattanooga was much more segregated than it is now. It still is, of course, in many ways. But there were several Klan groups operating and active in Chattanooga at that time. I've heard that there was up to six separate entities and iterations of the Klan. And there was also a predominantly Black community in and around the 9th Street area of Chattanooga, which is where these Klansmen targeted the victims of this crime. So it's a very different city than it is today. Of course, there's remnants of that. And we've recently seen the Klan reemerge and go public again. So as much as I think about the city as being very different, there's, of course, many things that are still the same.
Yeah. So tell us what happened on April 19th, 1980 in Chattanooga.
So on April 19th, as you said, 1980, three Klansmen in a car, actually there was another car accompanying them, tried to set a cross on fire in the heart of Chattanooga's Black community. They failed and decided to go on a shooting spree, shooting a automatic shotgun out of one of the cars at four Black women who were just coming out of a club and waiting for a taxi, and a fifth woman who was tending to her garden in her front yard. And fortunately, the women were not killed, but of course severely injured. And the Klansmen were quickly arrested. They were known to the local police. And what we might hope would result in a criminal trial that saw them sentenced to time resulted in two of them being acquitted and the third, sentenced to only a few months in jail. And so these women, seeing that justice was not being served in the criminal courts, decided to pursue a civil trial. At the time, this was fairly novel. And fortunately, they had the help of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, who was aware of this violent act and had been searching for a trial and an opportunity to try one of the original civil rights laws from 1871 called the KKK Act, which had been largely left dormant for, what had roughly been 100 years. And so working together with the women, they pursued a civil action and won. Mm-hmm. And, now this is something that we see fairly common in cases of racially motivated violence or police violence when we don't see the results we're hoping for out of a criminal case, a criminal court. And so they won and set a precedent that lawyers around the country started using to bankrupt Klan groups all over the U.S.
Yeah. Let's go back to these women for a minute. For these women, the 1980s, to consider taking the Ku Klux Klan to court. That is bravery. Talk about what motivated these women to take this risk and the dangers they were exposing themselves and their families to. I just can't get over how courageous and brave these women were. This was scary for them.
You know, it is important to remember how terrifying this would have been. The Klansmen, with two of them being acquitted, one of which was the leader of this local group, were now roaming around the streets again and weren't being, you know, continuing to be loud and make themselves known to the community, and were even celebrating the fact that they were acquitted. One of the women, I think, you know, perhaps multiple as well, were still receiving threats. And, you know, at the time, these incredible women and the lawyers understood that for many of these situations, this was kind of the end. The criminal trials would deliver, you know, the equivalent of a slap on the wrist, and they would be left to kind of fend for themselves. And so I think, you know, what their families have shared with us is that they were tired of this, mm-hmm. and just didn't want to see their families, their communities subjected to anything like this again. And so whatever they could do to stop this from happening again, they were willing to do, which is put themselves in danger again, to make themselves known and to stand up while the Klan was still active, while there were still threats of violence. And, you know, as challenging as it is making a documentary, I can't even imagine the bravery it took for these women to say, we won't stop. We want to find some semblance of justice, mm-hmm. and to show people that this is not going to continue, right. In any way, shape, or form.
It's surprising that the women would even have faith in the justice system after seeing two of the three perpetrators acquitted and then the other one sentenced to just 9 months in jail. Was it difficult for the Center for Constitutional Rights to persuade the women to go forward with the civil case, or, you know, they were just on board right away?
Randolph McLaughlin, who is the lead attorney from the Center for Constitutional Rights, who came and lived in Chattanooga and worked with the women along with his team, he shares that, you know, when he was kind of setting expectations for these women, that they were completely unsure of the results of the case, that it it might not go their way, that this might result in another defeat, and asked them participate in the hopes that there would be something that they could then take to the rest of the country. But as he shares, you know, even in our film, he explained to them that this was a test case, and that, you know, they might not get the justice they want, but if they were willing, it might open a pathway to stop this from happening again. And all of the women agreed and said, we would like to do this. We want to try. And again, even that, you know, it's something that now I think people understand as a pathway, but in part only because these five women decided to do that back 40 years ago.
Yeah. And you say they were unsure. And matter of fact, when they won, the lawyer that you're speaking of, he was shocked. He was like, oh my God, we won.
It is amazing to hear him retell it, as well as the other members of his team. And, you know, it really was something that they were kind of, you know, sitting on pins and needles waiting to hear this judgment. And they truly did not know which way it was going to go. And yeah, to be sitting in that courtroom, and we were able to bring the lawyers back to the courtroom as well to kind of share with us their experiences and talk about where they were sitting when they heard the judge give these results. But it is amazing to think that they really had no idea which way it was going to go.
Right. And of course, they were awarded compensation, but They didn't receive much of that, did they?
That's right. You know, it is part of the duality of this story, as there commonly is, that it was, you know, a victory and a success, and yet also, you know, a challenge to find the money. One of the Klansmen was able to move a property that he owned out of his name, which they did return back to his name, and that resulted in some money going to the women. But these Klansmen, didn't have much, also is part of this story. And the leader of the Klan, the local faction, was actually perpetrated another crime shortly after this and is still serving two life sentences. And so they weren't able to get any assets from him. And the lawyers also remind me that there was no real kind of set of standards as to how you would go about getting this money. And there is now, and ways to get money from people's wages and their property and assets. But because this was kind of a first of its kind, they were learning as they went. And I think he has some thoughts about how maybe they could have pursued things, but this was very much a first of its kind civil trial.
Yeah, and the one that got the 9 month sentence, he admitted, right, that he was shooting the gun. Did what he say? He didn't mean to hit anyone, but yet, what they even used, rather, like they talked about the buckshot versus birdshot, right? Birdshot makes a smaller hole, but there are hundreds, and you can't get these little birdshot pellets out. They come to the surface of the skin. It's very painful. So these women went through a lot of health issues following these shootings.
That's right. And I mean, this is still a struggle today, but it's easy to forget how much pain and trauma these women endured, and not just themselves, of course, but their families and the people supporting them, and the fear they lived with, not only because they'd been attacked by America's oldest and original white supremacy group, but because they were going back into their lives and trying to find a semblance of normalcy. And sadly, one of the women passed only within a year after the civil trial. And it's of course a testament to their resilience and bravery that they took this on, but of course tragic that they had to, that this was even something that they were forced to confront with such little hope.
When did you first learn about the Chattanooga Five?
It was back in the kind of first few months of 2020, and kind of oddly enough, it was just from a Facebook post where someone was mentioning a Klan attack in Chattanooga. And something, I thought, well, even growing up in Boston, I surely would have heard about this. And so I asked neighbors and friends and colleagues, because I was working at the local PBS station actually at the time, and everyone had the same response, which is, I don't know what you're talking about. I've never heard about this Klan shooting. And that response over and over again just kind of wouldn't let go of my curiosity of why don't we know about this? What actually happened? What is this story, and how can I learn more? So just so strange, but simply from a Facebook post, I started to hear more.
Facebook and curiosity, right? And that's where this idea came from to make this a documentary. I mean, once you learned about the precedent-setting case, I'm sure that was like, yes, this is a story I have to tell.
Absolutely, absolutely. This is my skill set, and I think if I was a writer, that's how I would have approached it. But being able to absorb and learn and empathize with so many different stories in our history, to me, it felt like, well, at the very least, I've got to document this in some meaningful way so that when people learn about the Chattanooga Five, they have somewhere to turn to get more information.
Yeah. As you mentioned, you talk with the attorneys who tried the case. They even had the case files, and you have them going through some of the old case files. What was it like for them to revisit that case?
Some of the background behind the scenes of getting access to those files is that, of course, we were filming this during in the midst of the pandemic, and I first learned that the case files were housed at NYU's archive, and I thought maybe the Center for Constitutional Rights would have them, but they had donated them. And contacting NYU, they let us know that the first appointment they had was 18 months in the future. And so, thinking, okay, maybe we'll never see these. We were patient and took that appointment, And we were actually the first people allowed in the library and into the archives after opening up for the closure for COVID. And so not only just being there, but being the first people inside the building and seeing these files, it was astounding. And I feel so privileged to be able to document Randolph McLaughlin's opening of these files. And I remember he, as soon as we got in the room, he wanted to open them and start looking through. And I was like, well, let me turn on the camera. Let me at least turn, start rolling here. And, everything's in his handwriting. And there's so much, of course, that we film that's not in the documentary, but I still get chills thinking about that moment where he was able to kind of go through all these papers. And he even found some cassette tapes that we didn't know existed. From a press conference that the Klan had held in the midst of this trial, which is also featured in the documentary. So it was a powerful moment for sure.
And how did you track down the women? And you were not able to track down all of them, right?
Sadly, all well, four of the women have passed. Miss Opal Jackson is still with us, and unfortunately was not able to be interviewed, but we were able to film somewhat with her, as well as her daughter and granddaughter. And, it is amazing that after 40 years, the families of these women have kept the legacy alive through sharing the story with their community and their family members and extended friends. But it just hadn't reached, that point of someone wanting to document it. But the story has been shared and passed down through the decades. But I was, of course, sad to realize, this is what happens with time. If no one's there to kind of ask those questions of what happened, our history is lost. And we preserved as much as we could, but of course, there's so much more that we just weren't able to capture because these women are no longer with us.
Talk about the impact of the case on the families of the Chattanooga Five and that larger community.
It's amazing to both see how they'd carried the story over the last 4 decades, doing local history reports in their school about it and talking amongst friends and family with it and celebrating the women. But to see also the influence the documentary has had now, one amazing part of this story is that the Fannie Mae Crumsey Foundation. So Fannie Mae Crumsey was one of the five women who was shot just tending to her garden. Their family started a foundation in 2020, almost exactly around the time that we started our film. And their foundation is now being, celebrated in our community. They just held a screening on Juneteenth of the film that also kind of brought awareness to their foundation. And they really are continuing the legacy of Miss Crumsey, who was a matriarch of her community, who would care for anyone who walked through her door. And, there's many people who I've talked to who didn't know about the shooting, but did know who Miss Crumsey was and was aware of her presence in the community. So they've really been able to use this film to draw even more attention and to get more people to recognize the legacy that she and these women have had in our community for 40 years. And now it's just kind of taken it to another level where I think people can understand that in the 34 minutes that our documentary plays.
I love when the lawyer is talking about the women. And he talks about, four of them being a little on the conservative side, but that Fannie Mae Crumsey was a hot ticket, let's say, right? You really got a little bit of a feel for her personality.
Absolutely. And she, this is of course before the age of the internet or even a 24-hour news cycle. But she continued to work with civil rights groups and do speaking events and shared her story as much as she could, even without the help of something like a film. So it is really amazing to see how she was a voice for this case and for this event.
And how this test case has proven to be very useful on civil rights cases around the country. I was surprised towards the end there when you started talking about the different cases that it's been used in and pretty much across the country.
It is something that we mention, of course, in the story, and we talk about the legacy of the cases. But one of the reasons is there was a very high profile case just a few years later that took place in Alabama. Many people know of this case. It's the case of Donald versus the KKK, and that resulted in a $7 million damages award. The local Klan group had to sell a massive property because, of course, the lawyers were aware now of how to actually recoup some of this money. And that case became a national story. And there's actually several documentaries about that case. And the lawyers who tried the case were aware and in contact with CCR and their successful case in Chattanooga. But just because of, the way things go, that case has always been celebrated as this initial kind of spark that set off all of these other cases around the country. But and that came out of the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery, and they have been really gracious and kind of pointing to Chattanooga as well. Actually, this was the first case that really showed us what to do. So we've also been able to write a little bit of that history, while really the goal is to celebrate all of these cases and to show how powerful they've been throughout the years.
We're talking with John Beter. His short documentary, How to Sue the Klan, The Legacy of the Chattanooga Five, won the 56th NAACP Image Award. It's currently screening on multiple platforms, including PBS and YouTube. It'll be screened in Falmouth on June 25th, and we're going to post information about that at our website, capeandislands.org. We're going to shift the conversation to present-day challenges to civil rights and what our community can do to ensure civil rights for all. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point. In June of last year, the Supreme Court issued a historic decision, effectively ending race-conscious admission programs at colleges and universities across the country. Under the Trump administration, we've seen the dismantling of diversity, equity, and inclusion in all aspects of government and government-funded programs. And we've witnessed the targeting of non-criminal migrants for deportation without due process, which has undertones of racism. For the remainder of the hour, we'll talk about what appears to be a rollback of decades of civil rights advances of our country, how that's impacting people of color in our region, and what we as a community can do to promote and protect civil rights. With us is John Beter. He's an Emmy-nominated filmmaker whose documentaries explore themes of resistance and social justice. And joining us, Tara Vargas-Wallace, founder and CEO and president of Amplify People of Color Cape Cod. Welcome back, Tara. Good to see you.
Thank you, Mindy. Happy to be here. It's an honor.
And Reverend Will Mebbin from St. Barnabas Church in Falmouth. Hi, Will. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mindy.
As we referenced at the top of the show, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. reminded us that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Well, I want to start with you, given your long history in the civil rights movement. Does it feel that that arc is still bending towards justice, given our country's trajectory?
Oh, I love what the attorney said, McLaughlin said in the documentary, that it's up to us to reach up and pull that arc down. And, I've lived long enough now to realize that there have been cycles when it feels like we really are making progress and that we have codified the rights that every human being should have, the civil rights and human rights that people should have. And then we find a period like now, where those very rights, those things that people died for, are indeed being rolled back, as you said in your lead-in to the question. So I have periods where I'm hopeful, but I continue to believe that I don't know that we'll ever be where I would hope we would be during my lifetime, Mindy.
Tara, what are your thoughts?
Yes, well, first, I'd just like to thank you again, Mindy, for having me. It's an honor to be here. And to John, your film is deeply bold and necessary and powerful. Thank you for being the vehicle to telling that truth. So, people think civil rights, they think of civil rights as something settled in the past. But the truth is, as people of color, right here on Cape Cod, we're still facing We're still fighting for basic equity and dignity. You know, at Amplify, we see disparities every day in access to affordable housing, quality health care, education, fair treatment by law enforcement, and economic opportunities. And these inequities are, you know, they're not theoretical. They are deeply personal. BIPOC students are still experiencing racial harassment in schools. Immigrant families, as we know, are navigating systems that weren't built to support them. And businesses of color are routinely left out of funding, resources, and networks that help others, that help them thrive. And, you know, these are all modern day civil rights issues rooted in systems that were never designed for us to succeed.
I love what you said, Tara, about people think of it as settled in the past. I think that's so true. John, what are your thoughts?
You know, it is kind of astounding to think of the start of this production. And, you know, not that we weren't aware of what was happening in the country, but just how different it was between the genesis of talking with the lawyers and speaking with the descendants of these families, to then realizing, this case law is being used now. And not only is it being used now, but it's incredibly necessary and vital that we have access to this. And I think, you know, becoming closer and closer with Randolph McLaughlin and the time that we spent over the production of the film, you know, seeing it through his eyes of 40 years ago, I fought this and I've been so proud, and yet now it's so necessary once again. I think it's you know, it's heartbreaking really to think about how many more civil rights lawyers we need today than we even had access to back in the 80s.
Yeah. After the murders of Trayvon Martin, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and others, there seemed to be a shift in our country, a reckoning with racisms and a realization that the onus for change was on white people. I'm thinking about this because that was a revelation to me, too. We actually did a program here, and it was about Asian Americans, and we had a professor on, and she said, this is not their problem. This is your white people's problem. And I was like, wow, she's right, you know, and they created this system. We created this system, and we're the ones who have to change. But so I felt a real optimism. And, Will, you were the one at the time who said, we've been down this road before. You know, you were very, where I was like thinking, yeah, this is great. You were like, I don't know. We'll see what happens. So why do you think the pendulum has swung so far in the opposite direction in this last year?
Well, I believe because the white nationalists who are KKK in disguise, now wearing suits and ties and members of country clubs and always have been, they've been given permission, Mindy. Mm-hmm. All right. Take a look back. Let's go back to Charlottesville. We all remember what happened there. And the president at the time said, about those who attacked and who were screaming, Jews will not replace us, and carrying tiki torches and beating up on black and brown people. The president said, they're very fine people on both sides. We fast forward to January 6th and the insurrection that took place on our nation's capital, where every single member of Congress was in danger, as well as the Vice President of the United States. And now the current president says, let those people go. They're patriots. They should not have been prosecuted. So there's example after example after example of permission being granted today to white supremacists, white nationalists, to carry out the very terrorism that is reflected in the very well produced and directed, executed film that John has brought to us. So they have permission.
Mm. Tara or John, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, you know, something that happened only a few months ago is, you know, not that they had left, but the Klan has reemerged and gone public again in Chattanooga, all over the country, of course, but you know, to see flyers being distributed amongst our neighborhoods, calling people to the Klan and asking them to join, and also telling people to self-deport now before it's too late, you know, the boldness and just, you know, fear that they've always kind of been sharing and spreading, just to see how, like, you know, they just don't have the same fear of going public and, you know, asking people to join their cause. It's, you know, at the same time that we're doing screenings of a film called How to Sue the Klan just down the street. It's unbelievable, and also just exactly what Will was saying, you know, something that you can easily see the connection between presidential pardons and a group feeling like, well, let's start recruiting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tara?
Yeah, no, it's already been said. Both Will and John very, you know, explained it very well. I think people have just been emboldened and been given permission. And, you know, this is why we have to be courageous. We have to be bold. And this isn't a time for us to retreat and allow the fear mongering to paralyze us.
Mm-hmm. And we need to, Mindy, we need to remember that this kind of intimidation exists right here in Falmouth on Cape Cod, mm-hmm. idyllic Cape Cod. I've attended several of the rallies that are being held on the Village Green on Saturdays, and it's amazing some of the vitriol, some of the hatred that is spewed towards the attendees of those rallies, coming from people waving American flags and what have you, who are masquerading as, maybe they are actually members of the Proud Boys or other organizations. So that intimidation, that fear is right here mm-hmm. in Falmouth.
Yeah, not just Falmouth, everywhere, right?
Yes, yeah, indeed.
Tara, white people might be alarmed at the dismantling of civil rights, DEI programs, and affirmative action, but it's likely not impacting their day-to-day lives. That's not the case for people of color, even here in Massachusetts. Talk about how our local community is being impacted by changes that are being made at the federal level.
Sure. So, you know, the recent backlash and rollbacks to DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, both locally and nationally, are deeply concerning. You know, these efforts are often presented as neutral or colorblind, but in reality, they strip away the few tools we've had to address generational inequities. Removing DEI efforts doesn't level the playing field. It reinforces a status quo that has always excluded and marginalized people of color. And I want to keep it real. There are many Black and Brown folks who feel that DEI never truly worked for them. And in some cases, they're absolutely right. DEI has sometimes been watered down into tokenism or symbolic gestures without structural change. But in the hands of those who do the work with intention, especially in Black and Brown-led organizations and institutions, DEI has created space, it's created opportunities and healing. And it's helped businesses of color, in particular, access funding, leadership development, and community support. So instead of abandoning DEI, we need to deepen it, make it more accountable, more community-rooted, because when equity work hasn't worked for everyone, the answer isn't to dismantle it, it's to do better.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about challenges to civil rights and what our community can do to ensure civil rights for all. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us is John Beter. He's an Emmy-nominated filmmaker whose documentaries explore themes of resistance and social justice. Tara Vargas Wallace is founder, CEO, and president of Amplify People of Color Cape Cod, and Reverend Will Mebben from St. Barnabas Church. Earlier this year, we did a program about the dismantling of the Woods Hole Diversity Initiative. And this program was established decades ago and brought college students who are underrepresented into the science and technology to Woods Hole for academic opportunities. The initiative was disbanded by the six scientific research organizations shortly after Trump took office. And and I guess this is a question for Will or Tara, is this an anomaly, or are we seeing other local DEI programs shutter?
Well, DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, has been replaced with division, inequality, division, exclusion, and inequality. And so it's not a one-off what happened here in Woods Hole. What I found so amazingly hypocritical, I had a chance to see the letter that was from the six institutions in Woods Hole getting rid of that program. And it was amazing, paragraph after paragraph after paragraph extolled the virtues, the goodness of the program, talking about how this is exactly the sort of thing that should be happening. This is what all of the institutions in Woods Hole are committed to. Sentence after sentence after sentence. And then they got rid of the program. So I'm like, wait a minute. You just spent a whole page talking about how great the program is, but you're going to get rid of it. DEI, it has been, as we've seen in universities and all across the country, those programs are under attack, and the courts are backing the administration.
Yeah. Tara, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree. I think I like what Reverend Will said about, it's become division, exclusion, and inequality, and that is so true. And again, all I can say is this is a time for us to really be courageous and make sure that we're standing up and speaking out for what is right.
Have you heard of organizations or institutions who are doubling down on their efforts to promote diversity because of what's happening nationally?
There are some examples of that, and I'll reference Falmouth Hospital here locally. Shortly after the administration said, we're going to get rid of DEI, scrub it from many and everything in the federal government, I was sitting at Falmouth Hospital, and I was watching their computer screen, and it was promoting Women's History Month in March, and was talking about how proud the hospital was to be promoting women and raising up women and acknowledging their contributions to society. And I thought, wow. And then another slide came on, and it was talking about Black History Month, what had just happened in February. So I was like, oh my gosh, here in the middle of all of these attacks on DEI, here's a hospital that's saying, no, we believe in diversity. We believe in equity. We believe in inclusion. So that's just one minor example, but it caught my attention.
Yeah. How about Tara? Are you seeing anything, locally, are you seeing anything that like Will is explaining?
Sure. One particular organization that comes to mind is the Cape Cod Foundation. I mean, they've been incredibly supportive and progressive and in not allowing, harmful policies to impede their work of funding important work that's being done out there, like Amplify, that, for lack of a better word, amplifies DEI.
Mm-hmm. What about for you, John? I know you don't know so much like locally, but are you seeing, especially like reaction to your film, are you seeing people going, we need to double down on diversity, equity, and inclusion?
I live in Chattanooga, and I've made it a point to let people know that if we had started this film today, it would not be able to be completed. It would not exist. And the production started in this window of time where people wanted to devote resources and money to things like films, especially created and led by a team of people of color and about Black history and American history, and that's not the case anymore. And, it's astounding to me to see how many organizations that funded us have also let us know through their newsletters and social media that all of those programs are gone, that money does not exist anymore in some way, shape, or form. And, even in the midst of production, we came across so many other stories just before, just after, just left and right of ours that needed to be told. And I'm still horrified by the idea that those now have no chance of being shared because of things, the state of things right now.
You know, far be it for me to give credit to Harvard University, my being a graduate of Yale, but I will. Harvard, I was heartened. Harvard came back and said, no, we are going to resist your efforts to scrub our DEI initiatives here, and we're going to continue down the path we are on. And so I give them credit for that.
You know, I wondered why they didn't do it sooner, actually, because, you know, you look at the endowment that they have and you go, all right, really, how is that really going to impact us that much? And really taking a stand, and thank goodness they actually did do that, right?
Yeah, better late than never, right?
Exactly. The Trump administration is making the argument that merit, not race, should decide who gets hired or accepted into colleges and universities. Without an understanding of our country's history or systemic racism, and not just against blacks, but many non-whites, that argument might seem reasonable. If you're not educating, and we're not educating ourselves about our country's past, or honest with ourselves about our past, can we have productive discussions about race and racism in our country going forward?
Those who don't know their history are destined to repeat it, someone famous once said. No, we have to know our history, and we will. You know, what the efforts, I read an article, I think yesterday, the day before, about how the Interior Department is now, after a director of an executive order from the president, is now saying in national parks, you have to scrub, you have to put down any signs, any evidence of protest, anyone speaking against the United States government or what's happening in the country. And I was thinking, I thought we had a Bill of Rights in this country. I thought we had free speech in the First Amendment.
Yeah.
And so, but those efforts, Mindy, and I've been saying this as I've spoken to groups around the area since January 20th, they're not going to win. They're not going to win. Goodness always prevails. Goodness always wins out. Good people like John Beter, good people like Tara Vargas Wallace are out there doing the work, organizing, speaking truth to power. And so this moment in time is a moment in time. Have me back in 5 or 10 years, and we'll be talking a different story.
Well, also makes me wonder, too, you know, how, you know, there's a lot of history we haven't been taught in school, right? And after the whole, you know, George Floyd and that movement, a lot of people went, wait a minute, and they were interested in that history, whether it be Native American history or you know, the history of racism. All of this history that we didn't know so much about, I still believe there are plenty of people wanting to still learn that history and are still moving forward to study that, you know, even though it's being, you know, oppressed by the administration. I have hope in that.
And I share that hope with you. There are more good people.
Yeah.
More people that want to, using language from my faith background, who want to love their neighbor than hate their neighbor. You know, you and I were talking before the program started about hate and, you know, where does that come from?
Mm-hmm.
And that's such a powerful word. And, you know, hate is taught. Hate is taught. No one is born into this world hating anybody because of their sexual orientation, their race, their gender, any of that. But people are teaching that to their children. So people need to continue to teach their children, uncles, aunts, need to teach their nephews, and mothers and fathers need to teach their sons and daughters about the goodness that exists in people and to not hate people.
That's right.
And that's going to prevail.
Yeah. Because of fear, because of potential retribution, there are people who can't take a stand. Then there's the rest of us. Tara, talk about what compels you to take a stand and what you would say to those who think that their actions or voices won't make a difference.
Sure. You know, I, as a woman of color, these issues are personal to me. As a fair-skinned woman of color, I feel that I have a certain privilege that my darker brothers and sisters do not have, and it's my responsibility to utilize that privilege in a way that amplifies all of our trials and tribulations, and that promotes solutions, that promotes that we all come together in a non-divisive way to bring solutions to the table. You know, we all have a responsibility in this work, ensuring that civil rights and economic justice, or economic equity rather, means showing up beyond moments of crisis. It means listening to those most impacted, investing in their leadership, and standing beside them in the fight for change. For businesses of color on Cape Cod, this means advocating for equitable access to capital, dismantling exclusionary policies, and building intentional networks of support. It means making sure BIPOC entrepreneurs are not only invited to the table, but given the tools to build their own. And so how do we press forward? Well, we speak out, we educate ourselves and others, and we demand better from our institutions, and we support organizations and leaders already doing this work. We push for policy change at every level, from school boards to state legislation. And most importantly, we don't give up. Because justice, it is in a moment, it's a movement, and we have to keep moving forward together. And like I said earlier, we have to stay boldly courageous and not allow the fear mongering to paralyze us.
Yeah. John, what are your thoughts on that? But people think my voice doesn't matter.
You know, in the midst of making the film, we encountered many challenges. And I remember I had the incredible privilege of seeing the great Angela Davis speak in Chattanooga right in the midst of production. And she talked about how so many of us think of, associate activism with sacrifice. And while that is sometimes the case, and we need people to protest and make documentaries and form nonprofits to combat what's happening in this country, there's also ways that people can integrate this into their work and their daily lives by having, you know, maybe awkward conversations or, you know, supporting people who need it. And I think that there's this kind of this thought of like, well, I don't know how to make a documentary, so what can I do? And I think we just all need to find ways to integrate that activism into our lives. And some, it's a very direct kind of straightforward path, and for others, it's finding small ways to kind of build it into your life. And you know, again, I wish we could all, you know, just make films and form organizations and protest and do all of the things that I think are necessary right now. But I often encourage people to start small, and to understand that from the small things to the big things, all are necessary and important.
Got about a minute left. Well, what are your thoughts?
Well, we need people to be allies in the effort to do what is right, to fight for justice. But we don't just need allies. We also need accomplices in that work. It's okay to stand on the sidelines and cheer and say, oh, I'm with you, I'm behind you, I believe what you're doing is great. Yeah. We need that. But we also need, from your listeners, we need accomplices. People willing to stand shoulder to shoulder with those who are threatened, those who are being abused, taken advantage of, to stand shoulder to shoulder with them and take the risk. Risk some friendships, risk some relationships, risk some jobs. Then you will be an accomplice in the fight for justice.
Very well said. Reverend Will Mebben from St. Barnabas, Tara Vargas Wallace, founder, CEO, and president of Amplify People of Color Cape Cod, and John Beter, Emmy-nominated filmmaker, whose documentaries explore themes of resistance and social justice. Thank you all for being here. John, thank you for the film. It was very powerful, and everybody should see it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.